This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
When a listener suggested we hear from Carrie Bowman about bioethics, I thought, bioethics? Who knows what that is? We don't have time for that in this climate emergency. But Dr. Bowman comes from the front lines. He was at the epicenter of the SARS outbreak in Toronto and had to be quarantined. Kerry was in the Congo finding the international trade of endangered apes. And just this summer, Dr. Bowman was the only Canadian in the Amazon able to report out the great fires of 2019. So this is everything but boring. Dr. Kerry Bowman is the clinical ethicist for Mount Sinai Hospital in Toronto. He works in family and community medicine at the University of Toronto and serves with their centers for both bioethics and the environment. Kerry Bowman, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Only slight correction there. I'm all University of Toronto now and no longer at Mount Sinai. But let me roll right in. How's that?
Okay, we've got that. So take us back to 2003. Why were you in a Toronto hospital where the police were called to empty out the place?
Well, I was there because I am a clinical ethicist. So that would be a person that's directly trained in bioethics working within the hospital setting itself. And although I'm a university professor, that is also the kind of clinical work that I have done for many, many years. So within a hospital, an ethicist might be involved in things like end-of-life decision-making, ethical questions and genetic testing. I'm Canadian, so we now have medical assistance in dying, meaning euthanasia, all of these types of things. So I was actually working in the hospital, you know, seeing patients and doing the many things that I do.
And could you talk to us about the links between the destruction of the environment and the most fearsome diseases like HIV, AIDS, or SARS, or Ebola?
Yeah, I mean, it's a bit of a tricky link, but it's definitely, definitely there. So, you know, some of the worst diseases that affect humankind, it's really diseases that are called zoonotic. And just as the name would imply, these are diseases that come from animals. And so you can get these complex crossovers of, you know, diseases, viruses that are emerging from animals. So in the African context, HIV itself is zoonotic. And although they're not the original vessel species, often the great apes would in fact be carrying HIV in the original, a different version of it, more of an SIV. But the original crossover, and that goes back quite a long time, by the way, really would have come from chimpanzees to people. The destruction of the forests of Africa and the incredible onslaught in the last 20, 30 years, and this is escalating, by the way, in which the forests are just being opened right up. And they're being opened right up because of logging. And then the bushmeat trade, that refers to the killing, slaughtering, and eating of all animal species within the forest. This has opened up human exposure to new pathogens in areas of the forest that were really never fully opened up to human beings before. The destruction of the forest, the destabilization of the ecosystem, and the physical consumption of animals. So that includes Ebola. This is where Ebola is emerging from. So SARS itself was also, now SARS is not African, SARS emerged in Asia, and so SARS itself actually emerged because of, although it's called something slightly different, the bushmeat trade. It was an Asian species that was mixing with human viruses that really triggered the SARS epidemic. And remembering, the SARS epidemic hit the Far East quite hard, cities like in southern China and Hong Kong. The only place out of the Far East that really got hit at all was the city of Toronto, and it was the downtown teaching hospitals because there was a Chinese-Canadian that had come over, and she carried it with her. So that's how it all came together.
So you are a member of the board of the Jane Goodall Institute, and you founded the Canadian Ape Alliance. Briefly, what does your group do, Kerry?
Well, the Canadian Ape Alliance, we are a group that, you know, I was really pretty horrified by what I saw going on in Africa with the incredible destruction of the forest and the slaughtering of so many species under the bushmeat trade. And so one of the things that we really wanted to do and I really wanted to do was to try and protect areas and environment to try and counter that. And when I speak of this destruction, this is not really an African destruction at all. These are foreign multinational companies that are coming in and doing the worst of the deforestation. So although many African societies, most, have eaten bushmeat, it's always been occasional domestic use and in most cases sustainable. What has really pushed it much higher is turning this into a major commercial enterprise that aligns itself with the deforestation. So I was witness to just the massive decimation of the great ape populations of Africa, having worked and traveled there. So I wanted to set up a group. And when I say set up, I don't mean a foreign group where we're doing the work. We were partnered with a Congolese NGO over there, and the Congolese are doing the frontline work. We're advising on some of it. We're doing some of the fundraising. But with all of this type of work, the most important thing, you know, there's no way a person can be going into Africa and focusing only on non-human species. The reality, you know, the geopolitical realities are such that people live within the environment. People are dependent on the environment. So the group that we've set up, most of the work we do, we've done microloans for women. We've got an environmental school, agricultural projects. And really the philosophy being that we have to protect and enhance human life as a way of protecting the environment. Now, that kind of thinking is much, much more common than it used to be. And so most of our work is really, really with communities as well, as opposed to very, you know, systematic work within the parks of behavioral observation of primates. There's some of that. But under these conditions, the most important thing is really to be working with people and trying to protect the species that are most endangered.
As we speak, Indonesia and its neighbors are encased by smoke from burning rainforests, and the last home for orangutans is still being cut down for palm oil plantations and viscose to make high-fashion nylon clothes. Do you think the great apes will survive our onslaught, Kerry?
I don't know. I hope they will. And you know, the great apes are wonderful and spectacular species, but you know, we use them in many ways to protect the entire ecosystems that they live within. You know, people's consciousness about these matters has been rising very, very quickly, but so has the problem. And the amount of people that are aware of deep questions like palm oil and just how destructive it is and how serious the Amazon fires have been. Now, of course, the great apes are not in South America, but there's many, many other species, including many other non-human primate species. I certainly hope it will. But, you know, the strongest thing I take, and this is something I suspect, you know, your listeners have heard many times by this, but I'll just reinforce it. It's that, you know, drawing these sharp lines between the environment and people has not been successful. And what we really, really need to be doing is looking at the two things and ways to balance those things. Also, we need to be as consumers. When you speak of palm oil in Indonesia, you speak of Africa and wood, or I speak now of Africa and wood, we need to educate ourselves, because that is where we can be most effective, to not be tied up with these multinational corporations that are doing the most damage.
So high in the jungle of concrete that we live in, we feel a nervous disconnection from our natural selves, I think. And some people fly thousands of miles for ecotourism in Costa Rica. Others go to Africa or Alaska to shoot trophy animals. But the well-meaning and the cruel share the same thing, Kerry. The effort to reconnect with nature actually means more destruction of nature. Surely that's a problem for bioethics.
Yeah, it is, because the more, you know, ecotourism is a very, very mixed blessing. And, you know, the defense of it would be the educational component is significant, and it's there. People that go off and see, the ecosystems, the animals, come back with pictures, it's got an educational component. But when I think of ecotourism, I'm thinking often of the great apes and the gorillas. And, you know, it's a very mixed blessing. But I would say in Rwanda, more than Congo, because Congo doesn't really have tourism, the amount of money that has been infused for the protection of the forest and the gorillas from ecotourism is huge. Having said that, I am very mindful that this is not an ideal situation. It's not ideal for anyone. The gorillas, the ecosystem, they're being exposed to pathogens. They're kind of becoming almost zoo-like, in which there's very established paths and routines. And this may be the unfortunate reality of 21st century experiences with endangered animals, is they're kind of like you know, fenceless zoos in a sense, because ecosystems become so fragmented. And so it's a very mixed file on this one.
So if we lose beloved or necessary creatures, what do you think about de-extinction?
Well, de-extinction, you know, meaning that we're, you know, we're going to keep, as you know, DNA and you know, genetic files of creatures and then a species, and then we can bring them back, reintroduce them, those types of things. To state the obvious, we're not at all dealing with the heart of the problem. And it's beginning to take a lot of people and things off the hook, because people say, well, you know what, if the gorillas go, remember there's a different species of gorillas, but if the mountain or the lowland eastern or western gorillas go, we've kind of got them on file. But also from a point of view of genetic diversity, are you kidding? I mean, we have such small samples on file. I mean, this is no way a sustainable element to it. So some aspect of their existence will always be stored, whether it's created or not. But, you know, they're a part of their ecosystems, and an ecosystem is a part of them. All of that will be lost. And I really don't think we can take solace in the fact that de-extinction is becoming an increasing reality.
Well, it kind of reminds me of Jurassic Park. I mean, what could go wrong? But let's head to the Amazon, as you did in the summer of 2019. What was it like as the wildfires grew to world-threatening proportions again this year?
It was a nightmare. I found it very, very traumatic. I was in an extremely remote part of the Amazon, and way beyond electronic contact of any sort. And we were beginning to smell the fires as we surfaced closer, into a more habitable area of the Amazon with more people. And then seeing the extent of the fires was really, really, really disturbing. And yes, the Amazon has fire every year, but boy, I draw your attention to a few things. One, the Amazon is not evolved for fire. So there's forests in North America, Australia, where I'm not saying fire is great because they're getting so much worse. But, you know, you have things like pine cones that will generate after a fire, those types of things. The Amazon is not. And the reason it has so much fire is that it's being degraded and whittled away at, and then they burn the peripheral areas. And then the intensity of the fire, you know, can roll right into the primary forest areas. And the destruction of non-human life and multiple species is staggering. So yes, fire is common in the Amazon, but it's common from humans. And to say it happens every year, well, you know, the extent of the fire is much, much worse. I tie this directly to the shift in government in Brazil. And now there's 9 Amazon nations and they've all got their challenges, but Brazil is the largest component of the Amazon. And I tie this very much to the new policies of President Bolsonaro, who's anti-environment, anti-science, and anti-indigenous. And I know that sounds like a strong thing for me to say, but just look up some of his quotes and it's all there.
And you say fair treatment and protection of Aboriginal rights is not just an ethical problem for thinking people. But can we really make the case that Aboriginal rights are fundamental to the protection of nature, including the rest of us?
Absolutely, absolutely. So let's look at the Amazon. So large swaths of the Amazon are considered protected indigenous territories. And within those protected indigenous territories, there's little to no logging, like mostly none. And so by protecting indigenous territories, we are actually creating a carbon sink. And indigenous protected territories from a human rights point of view and an environmental point of view really, really needs to be respected and even expanded. It's good for all life forms on the planet Earth, including people. That's what's very much under attack right now. You know, and I would say further with climate change, the absolute experts on its shifting environment and environmental realities and, you know, food security and species are very often indigenous people. So the amount of knowledge that they hold, not just in mitigation, but adaptation and resilience is huge. And, you know, one of the real horrors, and this is happening all over the world, but we really see in South America, is the erosion of respect for indigenous people and territories. So that's a huge one. Also, please remember, the Amazon has, in the Western Amazon, where I am often, uncontacted people. People living beyond any interaction with 21st century society at all. And these people are very much living in complete balance with the environment, and also their lives are on the line with this situation.
In many public venues, you've said we need input from diverse communities. Who are the communities put at risk by climate change who are not being heard in Western media much or at international conferences like the recent one in Madrid?
Yeah, you know, the problem is with so much with climate, it's falling so heavily on academics and researchers. And essentially, the people most affected by climate change are the people with the least voice. They're also the people that have contributed the least to climate change. So, you know, many people in the global south have contributed the least to climate change and are most affected from it. If you have money and you live in a nice house and you have air conditioning and heating, none of which is good, but you're really buffered from it. If you're living close to the earth in the global south, much more so. Those are the voices. It's getting better, but those are the voices that are least often heard, including Indigenous people. And that's one of the problems, is we've got to break out of this sort of academic-only cycle of looking at climate. There's a lot of science involved, but there's a lot of humanity. There's a lot of geopolitics. There's a lot of everything involved.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Dr. Kerry Bowman, a specialist in bioethics and a conservationist. We're talking about right action in a world now going wrong. Kerry, you help countries form policies. Tell us about your work and what you found in North Korea.
Yeah, you know, North Korea, believe it or not, and I say believe it or not because this might surprise some people, it actually does have a considerable environmental concern and really has for quite some time. So part of what drives North Korea's environmental concern is, you know, they're very isolated. So if there's a flood or a famine or something, which there has been in North Korea, you know, most countries, if we have a crisis, we help each other out. You know, North Korea, with the ambivalent exception of the People's Republic of China, is really very much on their own. But they had a huge amount of deforestation. And in the late 90s, they had some really serious problems with crop failure. And since that time, they're looking much more at sustainability. So, you know, North Korea actually is doing a lot of work with tree replanting, green roofs, those types of things. And so I, with the Jane Goodall Institute, was there looking at bringing in educational plans for people in North Korea, you know, just bringing in ideas and concepts, mostly for youth education, because they're incredibly mobilized because of the way they organize their society in a way that we could hardly even imagine mobilization, whether it's a classroom or an office building. You know, it's highly militarized. I've never seen anything like it. So in a lot of ways, they can execute these initiatives quite quickly. So there was a sincere search for ideas related to the environment. Now, we all know the other side of North Korea. It's a big, huge challenge, but they are trying. And then we would think, well, why do you need foreign people going there? I mean, they can just go online. Well, no, they can't, because remember, that's the only country in the world that can't go online. They're not allowed. So they're moving towards an intranet within the nation, which they mostly have now. But they don't have open access to the internet. So you can't just hand out a bunch of websites and say, we'll help you and we'll correspond by email. So there really was a very sincere focus on developing these things. And I would also say what was really good about the initiative is it gave them a chance to see, it really created a space where they could see that we as foreigners, I was on very small delegations, I was once in there on my own actually, they could see that we're really not what they were told we are. And we could see the same thing, that they're really not what we were told they are either. They're not mindless automatons. And that was very, very useful, these kind of cultural exchanges. And there's not a lot of them, mind you, but we did that about three times. And I think it was quite useful. This was before the change in the U.S. government. And, you know, a big influence on North Korea will be how the U.S. reacts to them. That's always been the case. So these were in earlier days. I was there before 2015.
And as we talked about, you have a wide range of jobs. What took you to Iran?
I was in Iran at a United Nations conference on looking at global ethical standards in Iran, including reproductive ethics and those types of things. So, yeah, I was interested in Iran. I actually met the president of Iran. I met a couple of the president, the former president, some people on the Guardian Council. And, you know, again, when you actually get into environments like this, you know, you find shared ground very, very quickly with people when you're looking at shared ground and you've got shared goals. And these kinds of exchanges can be extremely useful. And, again, so that people can see how you live and how they live, it was actually quite a positive experience.
Why did you call for early warning systems for climate change, and what did you mean?
Well, just to have a sense of what the indicators are. So early warning systems can be defined in different ways. But, you know, we really need to have a readiness to climate change, and we really need to have a way of being prepared for climate change. So we need early warning systems if there could be shifts in weather or storms or those types of things. And it's part of an overall capacity to build up resilience. You know, one of the real challenges from an ethical point of view with climate change is we've got mitigation. That means more or less, let's not make it any worse. And then we've got adaptation and resilience, which means let's adapt to it and let's bounce back from it. But here's the ethical challenge with that is these days we're focusing so much on adaptation and resilience. So that means let's adapt to it and let's bounce back from it. None of that deals with mitigation, which is how do we keep it from getting worse? And what's our obligation to future generations? That's, I find, very much falling off the radar. And there's an element of a little bit of giving up with this. Let's just adapt. And, you know, adaptation in 2020 will look very different than adaptation in 2080 or something, because it's going to continue to keep mounting. So I think we have to be very, very mindful to keep mitigation. Let's not make it any worse. Let's not keep contributing to it, to keep that central and not just focus on adapting.
So I want to go back a little bit to a panel discussion you participated in 2013, and something you said there. You were talking about multiple sclerosis and the cures for it, but this really seemed to click with something I've been thinking about climate. Here's what you said. You said, how did we ever get to the point where hope is a negative or dirty word? We can't have hope. We can only have evidence. The last thing we ever want is an approach where something like hope is purposely suffocated in people because it's not, quote, rational. So let's turn that towards climate change, where I find hopium is discouraged by some activists. They call it hopium. And scientists continually say, well, we have to wait for more research. Does your worry about hope apply to climate change as well?
Yeah. I think hope has to stay alive because, I mean, you know, once it's gone, we've got paralysis. We've got complete paralysis. And, you know, that's a very bad thing. And one of the things that really can suffocate hope is that people say, well, I'm one person. All the odds are against me. What can I do? But a person, an individual, can do a tremendous amount. We interface with all kinds of people's lives. And what I worry about is that, you know, if hope is suffocated, people will see themselves as being powerless in the face of this. So I do think we've got to keep hope alive and hope that the individual can make differences, including committing to larger, you know, differences on a much larger scale as well. But individuals can do a lot. You know, I'll give a very strong example. I've known and worked with, she's a good friend of mine, Jane Goodall, for many years, and she is one person, and take a look at what she has done. Now, I know we could say, well, we're not all Jane Goodall, and I get it. I'm not either. But boy, the individual can do a lot.
Now, it sounds macabre, but I'm wondering if your experience at the bedsides of people deciding when to die could apply to our own sort of psychology of perceiving mass extinction these days. Can hospice tell us something meaningful about our threatening situation?
I think it probably can. I mean, one of the things that we see so much at the bedside is sticking with the kind of reasonable choices that people have and respecting those choices and allowing the people to make decisions about what it is that they would want. And so, too, with a changing environment, you know, we still have a decision-making element for it. And I think that's very, very important. We can still stay in control of these things. So that's very important. And bedside work in Canada, it's been quite a journey because, you know, being Canadian, in the arc of my career, I'm seeing things at the bedside that, you know, if anyone was assisted with dying early in my career, that would have been a homicide charge. Now as a Canadian, we have medical assistance in dying. So I've seen a huge transition within this. And, you know, I have some mixed feelings about it. I'm very supportive of it, but I see it as ethically complex. But it also shows how far we can progress, even in a relatively short period of time, and how much human rights can be respected. And there's a relationship between human rights and environmental rights. So a lot of good things can be accomplished.
The timeless importance of families used to ensure a duty to protect future generations, but now it seems like that is failing. Humans so far are choosing to keep consumption and fossil fuels over protecting our own kids and grandkids from a climate disaster. What has happened to us, Kerry?
You know, we've never been great at what I'm going to call, and others have called, intergenerational ethics, particularly for the forward movement. We're very concerned about our children, as we should be, and that's a healthy and beautiful thing to do, and our grandchildren to some extent, and then it tapers off. But, you know, one of the biggest ethical questions with what we're facing environmentally is our responsibility to future generations. So some hardcore philosophers will say, well, you can't worry about people that don't exist yet, but that becomes a very academic argument. I would say that people looking back on us 100 years from now, or more, even less to some extent, you know, are going to say, what were people thinking in the early 21st century? You have people that, you know, by 2020 had not modified their behavior in any discernible way. It's going to be a shock. And I think we have to, it's really the first time in human history where we could possibly do this much harm to people that have not yet been born. And I'm speaking beyond our children and grandchildren. I'm speaking further out than that. We've never been in a position where we could do that much harm. And I would also say that, you know, for those of us who are living now, we are the most important generation, perhaps, in a lot of the human story, because we're either going to rise to this or we're not. We have power, and we have a kind of power that we may not want, but we have, whether we acknowledge it or not.
You're kind of a complex guy. You volunteered to study orangutans, got a master's in social work, then a doctorate in bioethics. I wonder, does that fit together somehow, and where do you see yourself going in the 2020s?
You know, at first I thought it didn't. At first I thought, oh my God, I've got these two parallel careers that don't have a lot to do with each other. I don't think that anymore because, you know, my work in ethics and my work in environment have increasingly merged. If you look at even the health element, the disease front, as I spoke about zoonotic diseases coming from great apes and the horrible things happening to great apes and affecting people or SARS. So there's crossover there. And I now teach full time at the University of Toronto. And, you know, I see it when I teach that I can very much move between environment and people more and more smoothly. In the 2020s, you know, as life progresses and I grow older, I'm leaning a lot more towards trying to do environmental work. This is the issue of our time. I don't know what I can accomplish, but I'm certainly going to try, and I'm going to try very, very hard to raise awareness about certain programs, to build some projects, and to continue to do that. I find my students are absolutely hungry for it as well, and hopefully some of them will feel a sense of encouragement to move forward with this kind of work as well. In fact, I know they will because a lot of them are very committed. So I'm kind of feeling good about being in a position to hopefully make myself useful.
From the University of Toronto in Canada, we have been speaking with Dr. Kerry Bowman, and you can find links to follow up on Kerry and our discussion in my weekly show blog published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Kerry, thank you so much for talking with us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you for your time.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Coming up, why are dead zones growing in the ocean? UK expert Sabine Lenger joins us to explore the dark life in the sea.
You You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
The media talks about dead zones in the ocean. Scientists prefer oxygen minimum zone. Whatever we call them, these large areas seem dead to life as we know it, and they're increasing around the world. Is the ocean dying? And what is the climate connection? There are questions and deep changes we all need to grasp. To sort it out, we have the lead author of a paper published December 2019 about dark carbon fixation. Dr. Sabine K. Lenger is a lecturer in chemistry at the School of Geography, Earth and Environmental Science at the University of Plymouth, UK. From Plymouth, Sabine Lenger, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hello.
Hi. So the plain language summary for your new paper says, quote, with global warming and increased nutrients from rivers, dead zones are forecast to expand. Sabine, why are dead zones going to expand with global warming?
That's a very complex question, actually. Basically, there's many things that contribute to dead zones, and some of these dead zones are unnatural, but they basically describe areas without oxygen. So things that increase the number of dead zones and the extent of dead zones is, for example, the presence of a lot of nutrients, increased nutrients running off from agricultural environments into the ocean, for example. They help to increase the number and areas of dead zones, really. At the same time, increased rainfall events, for example, can help soil erosion, and those transport even more soil and nutrients into the ocean. And this increased rainfall, for example, is linked to global warming. But then there's also other more direct influences. So the solubility of oxygen is affected by temperature, so there'll be less oxygen in the ocean if the oxygen gets warmer. And also, many natural dead zones are created through upwelling. So that means that nutrient-rich water from the deep ocean is being transported to the surface ocean due to kind of winds driving away the water from the surface ocean. And that will also change with global warming. Global warming can have an effect on that. And the last thing is that is stratification. So basically, I don't know if you know, but there's a gradient, the depth gradient of different chemicals or oxygen throughout the water has often a sharp boundary. And this is called stratification. So basically, for example, you have a very thin oxygen-rich layer on the top, and then there's a very sharp decline to an oxygen-free zone. And the stratification is also forecast to increase with global warming. So it's a complex question, and there's lots of things that feed into that. But most of the global warming effects will kind of lead to an increase in dead zones.
And the model we have for dead zones set up in the public mind requires that excess fertilization of algae from farm runoff and or human waste or some shore-based trigger. Is that the only cause of dead zones?
No, they're absolutely not. So there's coastal dead zones, and then there's open ocean dead zones. And a lot of the coastal dead zones, and for example, the Gulf of Mexico dead zones, is mostly created by this increased runoff. These are specifically dead zones that have been created by humans. And another example is the Baltic Sea. So the Baltic Sea has a vast dead zone, and that's linked to human activity. But then there's other places in the world, like the Black Sea or the Arabian Sea, where my study was based, but also some areas in the tropical north and tropical south Pacific, which are just natural dead zones, and they are created by other effects, natural effects. And in these ocean zones, it's upwelling, so basically the transport of nutrient-rich waters from the bottom of the oceans to the surface, kind of fueling the phytoplankton through that.
The International Union for Conservation of Nature, or IUCN, recently published a report on ocean dead zones. It was pretty scary. They said observed dead zones rose from about 50 in the 1960s to over 700 today. Sabine, to your knowledge, is there a ceiling for dead zones, a limit to how far they might spread?
So in the geological past, we have some events which we call as oceanic anoxic events, And some people argue that these have been global events and the whole global ocean. And some people argue that these only affected restricted basins or certain places. So I cannot really tell you whether there is a ceiling, but there are some people that argue that in the past, the whole ocean or most of the ocean was anoxic. And those events are usually connected to mass extinctions. So that was kind of when a lot of species just disappeared from the fossil record, changed shape, tried to adapt. So I wouldn't say there's necessarily a ceiling, because we have had events in the past where it seems to have been quite global. What's really important to note as well is that in these global or in these past oceanic anoxic events, if these were global, then even then this anoxia has developed over 10,000 and more of years, really. So what we have here now is we have this developing within only about 100 years or 100, 200 years. It's a very quick rise in CO2 concentrations. It's a very quick depletion of the ocean of oxygen in comparison to the geological past. So, yeah, I don't think we've had in the geological past an event that was such an instantaneous CO2 spike, because 100 years in geological timescales is instantaneous, really. You can't even resolve that probably in most records. Yeah, I wouldn't say there's necessarily a ceiling, but let's hope there is.
Have scientists seen dead zones increasing in size? I mean, how worried should we be about this, Sabine?
I think this is actually really worrisome, and the International Union for Conservation of Nature has published this report, and it is a very worrying report. I'm really glad that this has happened, because I think dead zones, well, for years I have, because I've worked on dead zones for about 10 years now, and I've always thought that dead zones are really disregarded, because they have huge economic effects. They have health effects, because at the same time when productivity rises, you often increase the amount of toxic algae, which then seep into the toxins, then seep into the shellfish. So you create a lot of kind of toxic shellfish as well. You have economic effects in terms of fisheries. You have effects on tourism. So if you have a dead zone, then, and you have dead fish washing up and stuff, then it's, or even if it's close to a dead zone and you start to kind of like, if hydrogen sulfide evolves, for example, it's not particularly for tourists a very attractive place to go. But also for fisheries, this is a huge problem, and people are seeing this in the Gulf of Mexico, because there's areas where they cannot fish, and when the seasonal dead zone evolves, because they won't find any fish. And if they fish at the edges of the dead zone or the oxygen minimum zone, what you find is that you find a lot of fish, because they're congregating there, because they cannot really go anywhere else. And you fish in this density, in these high density fish regions, and you have lots of very small fish that are being fished, and obviously fishing very small specimens is really bad for fish populations, because it means you don't give them the time to grow to proper size and to reproduce. So it has a huge effect on fisheries, a very negative effect. In general, it could have an effect on the whole number of species that live in areas where dead zones are developing.
Sabine Lenker, how did you get drawn into the study of these tiny bacteria and dead zones?
When I did my PhD about 10 years ago, we went on a cruise in the Arabian Sea, and we were studying these dead zones from farm and organic biogeochemists. So we were looking at basically organic chemicals. I look at organic chemicals in the environment, and I try to find out what's going on in the environment in terms of the microbes, in the present and in the past, and also the health of the environment. So that's basically what I do. But so we were going to look at all these different organic molecules that were present in the Arabian Sea sediments within the dead zone and below the dead zone. And we're going to see how they were different, and we're going to kind of do a whole geochemical study. And that's what we did as well. But we just noticed a very specific signature of this sediment, this 13C signature, and we've spent like years trying to explain it until we kind of figured out that it was probably the contribution of chemoautotrophs, so dark carbon-fixing organisms, that was creating this very weird signature. And that's kind of how I started really working on the topic of different contributions and the biogeochemical cycle like within the water column of the dead zone.
Are there still dead zones off the west coast of North America?
Yes, there are. So the Eastern Tropical North Pacific has a dead zone. That's a natural dead zone caused by upwelling. So the same process that brings the cold water to the west coast of North America is the same process that brings nutrients to the surface, and that causes the phytoplankton to grow very well there, and that creates a dead zone.
So there are regions where we are more likely to have dead zones, and certainly near the coasts where humans are putting off a lot of fertilizers. There must also be parts of the ocean where we're very unlikely to find dead zones that are sort of self-protected against this phenomenon, would you say?
Yeah, that's right. Obviously, where the circulation is quite open and it's very difficult to get stratification, that's less likely. So, for example, the Southern Ocean is productive, but there's no dead zones in the Southern Ocean at the moment. What's often causing this dead zone as well is the stratification. So that means if you, for example, if you really heat the upper bit of the water, then you get very cold water just straight below, so you get a sharp drop, and that kind of like increases the stratification as well. And that's obviously less likely in areas like, for example, the Southern Ocean. I wouldn't say they're self-protected because, I mean, in the Eocene, we have some evidence that the Arctic was overgrown with freshwater algae and these very organic rich sediments that were deposited there. And so if CO2 is high and temperatures are high, then ocean circulation changes and can create very different environments in the future.
Well, this whole field is so scientifically young. Obviously, we need more research. So to get a grip on this, I think it's time to introduce some new little friends in the sea. What are anammox bacteria, and why did we only find out about them in the 1990s?
That's a really good question. And anammox bacteria were discovered. They were discovered in wastewater reactors, and we absolutely did not know that they were there or that they could do this. But there has been a hypothesis that it is possible to oxidize ammonia anaerobically for a while before that, and it just very difficult to culture all these different organisms and to find out what they're doing. It's a lot of work. You have to be a little bit lucky, but you also have to be very, very good microbiologists to find out. So anammox bacteria, they are bacteria that live. There's different types, and one type lives in wastewater reactors and one type lives in the ocean. And what's special about them is that they take ammonia and they convert it into oxidize the species, and finally they release it as nitrogen gas, so they create deep nitrogen gas. But at the same time, they fix CO2, they fix carbon, so they're not a bacteria that eats organic matter, they create organic matter from inorganic carbon.
Wow, it sounds almost like an alien form of life that we've discovered in the sea. So when they capture carbon dioxide, which I gather would be deposited on the sea bottom when these tiny lives die and drop down, is that similar to the capture of carbon dioxide that algae can do further up in the light zone?
Yes, that's right. So that, I mean, the biochemical pathway is a different one than the one that algae would be using. But in principle, the principle is the same. So they take carbon dioxide and they convert that into organic matter. It's just that they don't need to use light for that. They get all their energy from inorganic chemicals. And that's why they're called chemoautotrophs. So there's photoautotrophs, and photo means they use light to fix CO2. And then there's chemoautotrophs, and chemo means they use chemicals to fix CO2.
And, of course, deeper in the ocean, there just isn't any light.
That's right. There's no light at the place where they operate.
What did you test in the Arabian Sea, and why there?
Basically, the Arabian Sea is quite an interesting environment, and what we tested was, what we really wanted to look at is, we had a signature of organic carbon deposited at the bottom of the ocean, and we used the 13C signature of it. So 13C is an isotope of carbon, so most of the carbon in the world is 12C, about 98.9% in the world is 12C. But about 1.1% is 13C, so that it means it has an extra neutron, so it's a little bit heavier. This 1.1% means it's 1.1 in general, but actually it varies a little bit. And depending on the type of life form that has converted CO2 into organic matter, it'll be related to that. So, for example, one type of life form will have 1.111%, and the other one will have 1.112%, for example. So that is quite a characteristic marker for who's been doing the fixing of the carbon. So we saw a signature of sediments that was deposited in the oxygen minimum zone that had this typical carbon signature that is related to Anamox. It had a lot less 13C than it would have had it been fixed by phytoplankton. And we used that, and we used a specific biomarker for Anamox bacteria, so a compound, a chemical that is only produced by Anamox bacteria, in order to find out how much Anamox bacteria are actually contributing to the sedimentary organic matter. And we found out that it could be quite a significant amount.
And you say this newly discovered type of bacteria can live at the edge or in the middle of these dead zones. So the dead zones are not really quite dead.
That's absolutely correct. Yeah, and I think that's the point that I wanted to really bring across. I mean, microbiologists know that these dead zones are not dead, but I think the amount of carbon that is being fixed and converted into organic matter in these dead zones has been underestimated. And at the moment, it is really only just considered that all the carbon that is present in this dead zone and below is coming from the top of the ocean, because that's where the bulk of carbon fixation happens in the photic zone. But actually, there's quite a lot of this is also going on lower down in the dark parts of the ocean. And people call them dead zones, but that's because there's no life as we know it. So there's no life that we can see, really. The only life that is there is pretty much microscopic, so there's very little in terms of multicellular organisms to find there. And there's no fish, for example, so fish will swim away if they're lucky, if a dead zone is developing, and there won't be any fish. So they call it dead zones, I suppose, after, because if a fisherman casts a net in this dead zone, then it'll come back empty because there won't be anything in there.
So this could be good news, because it says there is some carbon fixation and sequestration, even in dead zones. But reading the paper, I'm not clear how much these bacteria can sequester carbon, say, compared to algae growing in the sunlight closer to the surface. How do they compare?
And if you take, for example, a square meter of the surface ocean, and then a square meter of the surface ocean in the very, very productive areas can fix about maybe 300 grams of carbon per square meter per year. But if you take a look at the Anamox bacteria, for example, the way I determined it, this would only be much less than that. So it would be maybe 3 grams or even less. So it would only be 1% of carbon fixed compared to the surface ocean. And actually what is happening there is that organic matter that is down in the dark ocean actually fuels other processes that lead to nitrogen loss in the ocean. And also, Anamox bacteria, they produce some greenhouse gases, so there's also greenhouse gas production going on. So all in all, whilst this is fixing CO2, it's not actually like a good carbon sequestration mechanism, if that makes sense. And the organic matter that's actually present there in this dark ocean is adding to heterotrophic processes, so processes that consume organic matter and consume oxygen, and that leads to an expansion of the oxygen minimum zone. But in general, you're right, oxygen minimum zones or dead zones in the ocean, they are a feedback to a warming world. They are a feedback to increased CO2 concentrations, and they do, in general, draw down carbon and deposit it at the bottom of the ocean. And we have had these in the past, and most of the time they coincided with spikes in CO2, so with greenhouse worlds, and many times they also coincided with mass extinction.
Tracking the Climate Challenge, Radio EcoShock at ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Sabine Lenger from the University of Plymouth. And it's interesting, Sabine, I interviewed the Russian plankton scientist Sergei Petrovsky. He's in England now, and he said science is not yet sure on whether plankton will increase or decrease with global warming. Do we really know what to expect with this other form of bacterial life as the planet shifts towards a greenhouse world?
That is a good question, and we're not really very sure what's going to happen to the bacteria that live in the ocean. So that is it's obviously very difficult to forecast, but it basically depends on the amount of nutrient concentrations that are available. As they eat ammonia, it'll obviously make some sense for them to be a bit more sensitive to ammonia concentration, for example. And they are sensitive to oxygen. So if we decrease oxygen concentrations, they can increase in abundance, for example. So, yes, that is very difficult to forecast, but we are trying.
And then we have another type of marine bacteria that I've read about that don't need oxygen, but those ones produce the toxic gas hydrogen sulfide as a byproduct. Paleoclimatologist Peter Ward wrote about it in his book Under a Green Sky, and he talked about how that form of life might have sent clouds of deadly gases over the continents. How do those kind of sulfur-based bacteria relate to the ones that you studied?
So basically, I don't know, if you look at the biogeochemistry of the ocean, so of the biology of the ocean, then there's a number of chemicals that are used in order to eat organic matter, and oxygen is the most energy-efficient one, so that's why all the life tries to use oxygen if they can. If the oxygen is not present, there's all types of other compounds that can be used in order to eat organic matter, basically. And those bacteria that you were talking about, they take the oxygen from sulfate, which is very abundant in the ocean because it is a salt, so that's kind of, the ocean is quite sulfate-rich. They take the oxygen out of this and use it basically to oxidize the organic matter to CO2, and that's how they get their energy. But at the same time, they basically produce this H2S. So Anammox bacteria and these sulfate-reducing bacteria, usually they don't usually coincide very much, so they have slightly different niches. And in these oxygen zones or the dead zones that I was working in, these sulfate-reducing bacteria, they're actually not that abundant. But if you look at other areas, for example, the Black Sea, these are really, really abundant. And what's really interesting is that in previous dead zones in the oceans, if you look at the geological past, then these were also very, very abundant in many of them. And often, when they were really abundant, this was also related to mass extinction events. So we're not quite sure whether these dead zones that we have at the moment, these open ocean dead zones, can develop into these zones that have the sulfur, hydrogen sulfide present in very high concentrations. But it's not quite well known how kind of to get this. So there's biogeochemical models that are trying to work on this and trying to predict whether this might be the case. But in principle, with Anammox bacteria, they're not really working together, if that makes sense.
It does. So if this chain of ocean deadening begins with large amounts of algae, could seeding plankton with iron as geoengineering disrupt normal oxygen levels in the sea, or even lead to a change in the most successful organisms?
Yes, I think so. I don't think the seeding experiments are a very good idea in general. I mean, I don't know how thoroughly they have been studied, but if you start seeding the ocean with more nutrients, and you will get an increased production. Wherever you get increased production, you will get increased remineralization of organic matter, and remineralization of organic matter uses up oxygen. So it depends on where this is being done, but if this is in any place where it probably depends, yeah, on how much kind of oxygen is delivered through other processes, but there's always the risk of when you increase primary production or carbon fixation, then this will also lead to oxygen depletion. This is a bit similar. I don't know if you have a pond or if you live near a lake. In the summer, when primary production is high, there's many lakes that tip over into eutrophic lakes. So eutrophication as a process, and that has to do with temperature, that has to do with runoff and nutrients that are in these lakes. But whenever you get a lot of algae growing on top of a body of water, you risk creating anoxic conditions underneath.
What are the priority things we need to know from your point of view, Sabine?
Well, about dead zones, it's kind of quite interesting because it's a very complex issue and you can't really solve the dead zone itself. What you need to solve is the problems around it. So you need to solve the problems into agriculture. So you need a sustainable agriculture. For example, the Gulf of Mexico dead zone is caused by runoff from the Mississippi into the Gulf of Mexico. And the heavy fertilization on the agriculture kind of along this river system. And a lot of this is, for example, caused by cash crops that are being used to produce biofuels, so for example, corn. So agriculture is one problem we need to solve. The other problem is just climate change itself. So if we do not manage to decrease CO2 emissions, greenhouse effect, and the global temperature increase, then we can't really fix the dead zones either, because they will just develop as such, and we can't really change anything about that. So the root of the problem around the dead zone is actually found quite in a very complex and a networked system. For me personally, I think it's quite important to understand how these dead zones will respond in the future, and that also that we understand actually how the biogeochemistry works, because at the moment we can't really model the carbon cycle in these dead zones very well. So what I would find quite important is to do more research on the microbes that live there, what they do, and what kind of the amount of carbon fixation is that they do, what the amount of heterotrophic fixation is that they do. That can be done by many different approaches, and the best thing to do that is tackle this by using loads of different approaches, like molecular biology, genomics, transcriptomics or proteomics probably, and then I think I can contribute to this by using this approach, using biomarkers and chemicals that can help tell you about the signature of the organic material produced.
From the UK, we've been talking with chemistry lecturer Dr. Sabine Lenger, University of Plymouth. I will put links to this new science and a few helpful articles about it in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Sabine, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. You may wonder why I'm not covering other hot topics like the novel coronavirus sweeping the world, or America falling into a dictatorship where anything goes. Others are doing that. I did notice the Lysol index has exploded. People worried about getting the virus off clothes after going outside wanted Lysol disinfectant laundry soap. A 1 gallon bottle, about 2.5 liters, cost about $15 or less. Shipping dates at that price, coming from China, of course, are 2 to 3 months from now. Get it faster from American suppliers for the price of about $75, or that was a week ago. Now it's $150 for a $15 product. Whether the coronavirus goes pandemic or not, fear is stalking the world. Many times on this program, I encourage listeners to have at least a month's worth of basic food in your home, if you can afford the price of a bag of rice, some beans, and soup. Now is definitely the time. There is a small but growing possibility you may want to self-quarantine in your home, or be ordered to do so, for up to a month or more. Please think about what you could need and prepare now. The irony is, as we heard from our guest Jonathan Richards in February 2019, the survival food industry has crashed. There are hardly any suppliers left, and their stocks were minimal. The few that survived are now totally sold out. Their online order sites are empty. Even prepper foods on Amazon are mostly out of stock, and we don't know when they will be back. The food panic is already developing. Will the American stock market take a dive soon, as big companies from Apple to Ford shut down their lucrative Chinese factories and stores? When will companies in North America and Europe run out of Chinese parts and have to close as well? Regarding climate, halting air travel to the world's largest population and seeing empty streets in Shanghai means less carbon pollution. Maybe fewer people will fly around for fun after this or take vacation cruises. Perhaps when one door closes, another opens. But we cannot allow ourselves to become distracted. As hard as that is, there will be more and more urgent news, catastrophic storms, fires or floods, as climate change unfolds. But if humans cannot muster the patience and perseverance to track the story that could lead us all into extinction, then we will not make it. Whether it is popular or gets lots of hits on social media, I will keep digging into our climate emergency here on Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for paying attention and caring about our world.